You're listening to the Fanboy Garage Podcast.
Welcome to the Fanboy Garage. I'm Chris Lasanti, joined by my co-hosts, Vanana.
Hello, hello.
And a very energetic Aaron Varola.
Yo, what's up, folks? Welcome to episode 113 of the Fanboy Garage. As always, it's a pleasure to have you guys joining us for another episode. There's some stuff, lots of good stuff to talk about. The Mandalorian dropped a new trailer. I'm stoked about that. We've got Mulan numbers. We've got Cobra Kai. We've got some other stuff to get into. But let's get into Mulan, because Mulan, yeah, I think, was way more interesting than it needed to be.
Yeah, so, I mean, there aren't any official numbers yet, right? Though we won't really know those for a little while. But the speculation is that Mulan did really well for Disney Plus. And I know you had the numbers.
So it was I think if I remember this correctly, so Disney Plus sits at 60 million subscribers. That's as of like late last week, or
that's,
middle,
yeah,
of last
worldwide,
week.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yep, apparently some folks are speculating that up to 9 million subscribers paid $30 for that premium access to Mulan. Simple math tells us that's $270 million that just went right into the pockets of Disney, and that's huge. They're not splitting that with anybody. So when you think about, you know, a Disney film, you know, kind of being in the box office, like, they have certain splits that they have to take. And we've talked a lot about that on previous episodes. $270 million, and this is, again, straight up speculation,
right,
is nothing to scoff at. So that's pretty nuts.
Now, just so people know, again, Disney did not release these numbers officially. This is based on a Yahoo report that looked at a research firm called Seven Park Data, that calculated 30% of U.S. households with Disney Plus purchased a movie before September 12th, okay, which translates to over $260 million in revenue, like we just talked about. So those are estimates. It's not really based on any hard data. But again, you know, putting two and two together, looking at trends, they're looking at, like, the total subscriber numbers. All we know is that, you know, Disney clearly said that they were happy with the numbers, right? Now, it would not surprise me to find out that those... Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. It would completely surprise me if they did 9 million plus purchases for this. That, I don't think I even thought that that was possible. because that would be bigger than, like, any... Like, if you think about, like, pay-per-view events and things like that, right? I mean, you know, you do a million pay-per-view buys. Granted, that's a one-night thing, right? And chances are those, like, live sporting events and things like that usually don't have as much, like, repeat viewing or you know, after the first night viewing. But, like, 9 million? That's pretty remarkable if 30% of your streaming service paid an additional $30 on top of the money they were already paying for the service to buy this movie. And, you know, if it does wind up in the $260 to $300 million range, like you said, Aaron, that goes right in their pocket. I mean, you're not splitting that with theater chains. You're not splitting that with Amazon or Vudu or Fandango or Apple or anybody else, right? I mean, so this is a game changer if those numbers really turn out to be correct. Because the movie cost, what, like $200 million to make? $182 million,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
So
$200 million. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're not splitting any of that, clearly you don't have to make as much money. you would if it's in the theaters. I mean, to get to $300 million in your pocket, you know, with a theatrical release, I mean, you have to do, you know, $600 million or so, you know, worldwide, maybe even a little bit more than that. You know, so that's...
And that's with marketing and all that stuff. But then...
Yeah.
With Mulan, you know, we also have to remember that this movie hit previews. Like, they were in the preview stage, so they were definitely making some money before the pandemic hit. So, because they were, I think it was like 2 weeks or a week before that that they were doing previews, and then the pandemic hits, and then they pulled it. And then it's also doing, you know, it has an international presence, so... You know, in those situations, obviously, when it's in traditional theaters, it's going to have to do its splits. But, like, yeah, you're talking about a lot of money going into the pocket.
And I saw something, too, and I don't know, again, this isn't official, but there's estimates that they said that Disney may have actually gained, like, between 6 and 7 million subscribers, additional subscribers, within the days before Mulan got released. Wow. So, no, if that's the case, now you're tacking on... that number, right? Yep. Whatever that is. So if it's $7 a month or whatever, you know, you're tacking that on to, you know, that. So that's another, you know, 40 or so million dollars or whatever, you know, that goes into their pockets. Yeah. So this is huge. And, you know, I think this is going to be the wave of the future. Again, if these numbers do turn out to be accurate, I think that, you know, Warner Media with HBO Max would be crazy not to utilize something like this. You know, not every studio obviously is going to be in a position to do this, but you know, if you're Disney, right, you have this monster streaming service now that's yours, that's been established already. You know, you could court other places, right? I mean, you could court other studios, smaller studios that don't have access to this, and maybe you give them a better deal than they would get somewhere else, and say, hey, listen, we'll give your movie premium access for whatever, and, you know, we'll give you this percentage, you know, 70% or whatever the cut would be, you know, a better cut than what they would get any other way. I mean, that's another option too, if you're Disney, or anybody, really, for that matter.
It's just going to open up a new level and new arena of like negotiation and like cross, you know, collaboration between platforms and between, you know, companies and where they want to put their movies. But at the end of the day, Disney is the winner. I mean, like, they did so bad in China, you know, which I was talking about last week. They don't even need China at this point, you know, and a lot of movies that are coming out, you know, especially like the blockbuster movies, you know, they look to China for a big bulk of their numbers, right? Because there's so many people there. So I think this kind of helps them out a little bit, evens out the playing field for a movie that doesn't really spark any interest there.
Yeah. And, you know, it, you know, if you look at Tenet, right? So we talked last week about how Warner Brothers is like, they're going hard on theatrical, right? They're not even like with Wonder Woman 84, like they're not even talking about doing a VOD release. Well, Tenet is at right now 239 million worldwide. So this was a movie that they were hoping was going to do over 800 million worldwide in a normal time, obviously. So Tenet was a $200 million movie as well. Now, which would you have been now? Granted, I don't know that Tenet does the same numbers that Mulan did, right? On video on demand. But I mean, if those numbers are accurate for Mulan, they've already made more than Tenet, you know, until, you know, as of September 12th, which is more than a week ago, if that turns out to be correct.
And it went right into their pockets.
And it goes right into their pockets for the most part. Whereas Tenet, that 239, that's split. So, you know, Warner is going to take a beating on Tenet. They're going to take a big loss on that movie when they could have been more creative and could have put it out to a broader audience. Whereas Disney's going to wind up making money now on Mulan. You know, a $200 million movie released in the middle of a pandemic that's been pushed back how many times and barely is getting a theatrical release, and they're going to wind up making money on that. I mean, think about how crazy. Well, we assume they're going to make money on it, of course, with Hollywood accounting. No, no movie makes money, right? But
right.
But but Tenet, I mean, they're going to take a beating, and I just really wish that. And I understand Christmas is technically a long way away, but I wish that Warners would really rethink this and would maybe hopefully use this as an example and consider giving Wonder Woman 84 at least a hybrid release.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know what? 9 million, right? If the numbers are correct, 9 million out of the 60 million subscribers is such a small percentage. That's about, what, like 15% of... 30, your subscribers, right? That purchased this movie. So I think the $30, you know, for the movie did deter some people. And the fact that they did say, you know, you'll get it for free as a subscriber in December. So I kind of wonder if they had lowered the price tag, maybe if it was like $19.99, we would have gotten more people who purchased the film. It might have equaled out at the end, but to them, it didn't matter the other, you know, 51 million that didn't want to purchase it or didn't purchase it for whatever reason. The fact that they made back so much money with such a small percentage just goes to show the next movie that isn't Mulan, that isn't like a Disney, you know, PG-13 type movie that can kind of like rake in a, you know, a more broader audience, they really can kind of just break the mold. I mean, the possibilities are, you know, if you think about it, like, I don't know if they release like Black Widow or something like that, right?
If they were to have released Black Widow and do it at $20.
Yeah, don't you think?
Yeah, it would explode. I mean, you know, we talked about this before, but they at this point, because they had done this for the first time, $30, yeah, is absolutely preposterous. It's a lot of money to consider. Obviously, I mean, clearly, and again, it's totally speculative, but if $9 million people paid $30, right. Like, that's pretty, that says something, but it also means that they have now kind of set themselves up for a nice benchmark to say, okay, like, at the most premium for a film that, you know, isn't one of those blockbuster films, like, we can estimate that, to your point, 15% of our subscriber base are going to go for it.
So let me just give you some rundown, though, on where they get, because the 30% is what they've been talking about. So where they get that number from is basically there's 60 million, over 60 million global subscribers, but this movie wasn't available to everybody, right? Okay. It was only available to the U.S. market because we are the ones who really don't have the theaters open right now.
Right.
So the we don't know exactly how many subscribers there are for Disney Plus in the U.S. alone, right? That hasn't been announced. But so they're estimating that this is why a lot of this stuff is all just like it's estimates, because they're estimating that about 50% of the 60 million subscribers are in the United States. So, and then on top of that, they're estimating that 30% of that estimate purchased this film, which would be 9 million subscribers, which is how we get to the 9 million and the 30%. So it actually, when you think about it, if that's true, right, if there are 30 million or so subscribers in the U.S. and they got 9 million purchases, that's rather stunning to think that you could do that.
Yeah.
But as far as what you were talking about a second ago with the dollar amount, you know, I'm of the belief that and I think we mentioned this at the time, like, you're always better off starting high and going low if you have to, rather than going low and going up, right? It's very difficult.
Leave money on the table.
Yeah, because if they would have released this at $20 and it had done these types of numbers, then everybody would have said, oh my God, maybe they could have gotten more for it. But now you can't go up to $30 because that looks bad. But if this thing hadn't done well, to go down to $20 or $15 wouldn't be that big of a deal, right? It would have been a lesser move. So I actually think it's to test it out. You test out high, right? $30 is on the high end of what we would have thought you would pay for a movie like this. So to have this type of a response, again, assuming it's accurate, yeah. is amazing at that price point when you're already paying a subscription price for the service.
Right.
You know, I don't. I mean, it's just it's hard to believe. And yeah,
you go out say. And I'm just, you know, just for the sake of argument, say Black Widow is the next on the docket, and they say $20 for Black Widow. People are going to start doing in their head, well, damn, like, they just dropped Mulan for $30. Like, I'm getting a deal for Black Widow?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Like, the mental game that would be played there. People are going to jump at that 100% because they're thinking discount, they're thinking deal, they're thinking like, what? Yeah. They're giving us Black Widow at, like, you know, 10% discount.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty dope.
For me, I think if they are going to go, and I've seen even stories about how they think maybe Black Widow gets moved, you know, maybe to next year. But I do, if they do decide to go with this model for Black Widow, and I don't know that they will for a Marvel film, but if they did, I think they would be nuts to do it for less than $30 at this point.
Right.
You know, because you've already established that. And look, I mean, would I pay $30 for it? I might.
For Black Widow?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would.
I probably would. Yeah, I mean, I certainly would for Wonder Woman. So, you know, at this point, I think that maybe because people are used to, you know, spending money for big events, you know, I guess that's the key. I mean, $30, you know, in a time when, you know, pay-per-view, and I know a movie's different, but pay-per-view is, you know, $50, $60, sometimes $70, $80. I mean, there have been boxing matches that have hit about $100, I think. So, you know, people are kind of used to that. You know, movie tickets themselves are sometimes $20, depending on where you live and what kind of format you're watching it in. I know here, like in New York City, if you want to go see IMAX or even 3D, you were paying $20, sometimes even more, you know, for the ticket. So, you know, maybe it's not that crazy a concept. I mean, would I go pay $30 for Bill and Ted? I paid $25 for Bill and Ted. When you really think about it, I mean, like, that didn't seem crazy, but that, granted, that was a purchase, right? And you could, but technically so is Mulan, you know, in the sense that you're going to be able to kind of have access to it as long as you maintain your Disney Plus subscription. But like Bill and Ted, much smaller film, and I paid $25 to watch that once, even though I own it.
Yeah, I was totally going to pay $30 for Mulan until they announced that we would get it,
right,
you know, for free in December. And I was like, oh, this whole year has gone by in a flash. 2 months is going to feel like nothing. I'll be able to watch it in no time.
Yeah. And if that, you know, if these numbers do hold up, right, or they turn out to be accurate, then, man, I mean, to know that you could have watched it for quote unquote free, you know, 3 months from now, and people, that many people still chose to buy it, like that tells you that there is, I mean, do you need any more evidence that there's a market for this stuff? I mean, I don't know what else tells you that. I mean, here we go. We're charging more for this than we've ever charged for this type of thing, right? $30. We're doing it on directly through one service, right? That you have to have in order to access it. That's a monthly price. And we're telling you that it's going to be out for free on the service in 3 months. But people still went out and paid $30 for it. And could be millions of people, obviously, paid $30 for it. You know, again, I don't know that you can do this with every movie. But maybe you can. And maybe they should. Because if, you know, if you're talking about theater splits and all of that stuff, I mean, if that news does come out in November when they have their investors call and they do announce that, you know, and who knows what the movie will have made by then. If they announce that this thing, you know, made $300 million or whatever on the streaming, plus it added, you know, an X amount of subscribers to the service. And, it, you know, if it totals, you know, that the value of the film wound up being, you know, $350 million when you count subscriptions and all of that stuff. You know, I don't see how you, if you're a theater chain, you're not a little worried about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Disney aside, I haven't seen any numbers for Bill and Ted.
No, yeah. And you really, you don't usually see, I mean, it would be up to the studio to release those numbers, but
yeah.
I do know that it was.
Yeah, so I'm really interested to see how well that film.
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, yeah. I know it was topping a lot of the charts for sales and rentals, or it was at least in the top 10 in a lot of the charts, and also for the trilogy, because it got bundled with the trilogy well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was doing well. Now, what that means, I don't know, because I don't know where the... what the bar is, you know, for that. Yeah. Like, what do you have to do?
It was made on a shoestring budget anyways, I think.
Yeah. I don't know what...
Not all that much.
I don't know how many purchases or rentals get you to number one, you know, in a given week. So that's the problem, is we don't know that. But I'm sure it did pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what it was going to do in theaters either. That's the thing. You know, it's hard to gauge.
Well, it did. You know, it did the sort of hybrid.
It did, but it was very limited
hybrid
here
release. But it got nothing. I think it was like in 1,000 theaters.
Yeah.
So, cool.
So
all right. We'll see about Black Widow. I really think if they should either postpone it to 2021, you know, or just put it like do the Mulan model. If they want it to come out this year, because if it comes out in theaters this year, it's just not going to do well.
Yeah.
It's going to be like Tenet, you know,
yeah,
worldwide,
probably.
Right? Like
yeah,
other
absolutely.
People are other countries, you know, are making Tenet its money, you know, but not the US. Very low numbers here, you know, considering that if we weren't in the pandemic, Tenet probably would have been like one of the top films, you know, blockbusters of like this year.
The question I think is going to be, you know, two things for this year. One is when theaters are reopened everywhere, which will happen probably within the next month or so, I would guess. But that's just a guess. But let's just say by November, December, most theaters are open. How much interest is there in people going to the theater still? Like, how many people are still going to be hesitant to go? And also, you know, what is the capacity going to be? Like, limited capacity. Because even if you look at attendance numbers overseas, where theaters are open, but they still have capacity limits and stuff like that, 25%, 50%. I mean, it's $200 million overseas. You know, a movie like that, you would expect to do $500 million probably overseas, and it's not going to come even anywhere near that. So for me, yeah, it's ridiculous, I think, to try to release a movie only theatrically this year, because you just have too much working against you. You don't have theaters open everywhere. Even when they are open, they're at limited capacity, and you still have people that just aren't going to be interested in going to a theater right now. And you have an audience that has gotten more and more used to purchasing, renting, and watching movies at home through streaming services. And that's the one thing that shouldn't be lost in all of this, is that this concept was not, it's not that people had never rented, you know, video on demand movies before. They have, but you had people doing nothing but that now. For whatever, however many months that was, right? 2-3 months, 4 months. So it's become more commonplace, and people have become more accepting of it. And I think that you have all of those things kind of coming together now at the same time. I sure as hell would not release a movie only in theaters this year. I think it's a losing effort. And I think that, you know, the one thing you can learn from Tenet versus Mulan is that you're just leaving way too much money on the table if you don't try to release it in some way via streaming. And if you're Warner, again, like Disney, you have the ability to have your own streaming service. You can do exactly what Disney did with Mulan with HBO Max. You know, and you're also trying to establish HBO Max too at the same time. So
and
why
it
not
doesn't have
do
to
that?
Be Wonder Woman.
It doesn't.
You know, it could be another film that they just test.
Sure.
You know?
It should be Wonder Woman, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
You're right. I don't know. I just think that this is, look, even next year we're talking about how studios like Universal cut deals with AMC theaters, right, to shrink exclusive release window, right, the theatrical release window, where like a movie can, within 17 days of its release, it can go to video on demand. So we're already seeing these things in motion. So why resist that now? Like, you're in the middle of a pandemic, your movie is not going to make money right now, unless it was made for like nothing, right? Your big budget film is not going to make, has no chance to make money right now. So why are you still resisting doing the hybrid model when that's going to be the wave of the future in the not too distant future? Studios are going, 100%. Yeah, studios are going to be doing it next year, even when theaters are open for business. They're still going to be doing hybrid releases. They're still going to be doing, you know, video on demand releases within a week or so, a couple of weeks after the movie's opening weekend. Like, you're going to still have this. So it's mind boggling to me that a studio would be this stubborn to not at least test the waters and see what the market is like for their films.
Because they have the upper hand right now. Theaters are going to want something, you know? They're going to be like, all right, we don't, like, the deal that they already made. They're just like, we just want to stay afloat. So right now, these platforms really do have the negotiating power and the upper hand right now. I 100% agree with you. There's no reason why anyone shouldn't choose the hybrid model right now when it's the best option.
Sure. Yeah, you're just leaving money on. Again, it's proven now. We saw it with Trolls, right? We saw it with Trolls. We saw it. Now we see it again, maybe with Mulan. And we've seen it with Bill and Ted, even though we don't know the numbers. We do know it was, you know, topping charts. So that can't be bad. There's already a history of success there. So I'm not sure. And it's not like it's like a failing entity. I mean, yet we've already seen now movies that are only doing theatrical releases are not doing well. New Mutants is doing horribly. Now, granted, it was going to regardless, but it's real. I mean, it's doing even worse than it. It's even doing bump, but it may not be though, because it's doing so poorly, right? That you're telling me if they threw that on a streaming service,
it would have been so different.
If they put that up for rental or sale for $10. You don't think it would have done significantly better than it's doing in theaters right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. They should have, you know, when they should have thrown that up, like right the before moment. Labor Day, like in August, there was a period of like a couple of weeks where we really didn't get any new shows. Like, there was really nothing going on. I remember thinking like, oh, I can't wait for like Labor Day weekend, because there's like The Boys, you know, there's Raised by Wolves, like all of these, you know, new shows are coming out. There was a period in there where it would have been a prime spot to release it on demand, because even if someone sitting at home doesn't know about the movie or doesn't know about New Mutants, they're going to be like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'm going to check this out, because there wasn't a lot coming out at that time, and they would have done infinitely better.
Right. And I mean, I don't know what their contracts are as far as like how long they're supposed to keep the movie in theaters or whatever. But like at this point, pull the plug on it.
Pull it and drop it on.
Plug on it and drop it on. That should have been their plan all along. You know, like as soon as this stuff rebounded, they should have just figured out a way to do like a very limited theatrical release and then put it right onto a streaming service. And I think it would have done much better. Now, I don't know. I mean, now it might be so far out of sight, out of mind.
Well, because now the water is the what? Well, not that it was, I don't think anyone was expecting to get like an Oscar worthy performance film out of it. But now the word of mouth, for those that have seen it, including reviewers, not that that actually matters, but I think people are going to be completely turned off to
it. Sure. And you also have competition now.
Yeah.
You know, you have Mulan, you have Bill and Ted, you know, you got a bunch of other movies, so it's like, it's not a novelty anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Just continue to watch it.
Yeah, speaking of HBO Max, there was a very interesting announcement last week that came out, that it was actually the announcement that Harley Quinn has been renewed for season 3, the animated series that had been airing on DC Universe, the streaming service. But as part of that announcement, or at the same time as that announcement, it was also revealed that DC Universe is now out of the streaming video business. and pretty much all of the shows that are going to be renewed, right? Doom Patrol and Harley Quinn and stuff like that. Like, they're going to be on HBO Max. Some shows are also going to be on, like, Stargirl was already on CW, but now it's going to be, I guess, exclusively on CW. So they're out of that business, and that service is being converted into, I think it's called DC Universe Infinite, which is going to be a comic streaming service, basically, kind of like, you know, Marvel Unlimited, where I think it's $8 a month. You'll have access to like 27,000 comics, and you know, you'll have early access to like newer stuff. And so it's really just going to be that. And then the video content, the original video content, moves to HBO Max, which is a good thing. It's probably where it, we knew this was going in this direction anyway, right? When they announced HBO Max, we said it didn't make sense to have the competing services.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad that they're figuring out what to do with their comic platform. Mm. So, and I'll tell you, I was not the biggest fan of DC Universe the moment it launched. Like, I watched some of the content, but the user experience was just a total mess, in my opinion.
That's
so
you were on watching it on what, Apple TV?
Yeah,
on the Roku, it actually wasn't bad. I didn't find the interface to be problematic at all. So, but I just found myself not gravitating towards it. I mean, see, this is the thing. When you have people say, oh, there's so many streaming services, it's going to cost so much money. To me, it's not so much about the money. It's about accessibility. Like, I don't want to have to jump around to too many different services. So the more I can consolidate, the better. And for me, it's like, if you already have this one service that I'm paying $15 a month for, or whatever it winds up being, HBO Max, it's like, why wouldn't you, you know, combine all of that? Why would you charge me an additional, whatever it was, $6, $7 a month for DC Universe? Now it's like another service that I have to flip over to. And it's just like, you start to lose track of what you have after a while. Which is what happened with cable. It's like, you have all these channels, and it's like, well, I don't watch half of them. What do we even have? I don't even know. So you don't want to go to that. So yeah, so I'm cool with that consolidation. And you know what? The DC Universe Infinite, that's actually a pretty decent deal. I don't read Marvel. I've actually never been a huge Marvel comic reader. But DC obviously has been my thing. That's a service I would actually consider. Because I don't buy comics like I used to anymore, but every once in a while, like, something will catch my eye that I definitely want to read. And, you know, if I can have that service and have access to it and also still read some of, like, the classic stuff that I probably do own, but I may not own it, like, digitally, you know, like some of my favorite Batman stories and stuff, like, rather than have to pull those out or sort of stuff like that, it might be worth it. So I'm going to probably give that a shot, too.
Right, and, you know, at $74.99 a year, if you're an annual subscriber, you do get a $25 voucher from them for any, like, digital, you know, for anything in their DC shop. So I think that's, like, a cool incentive, and $75 a year is actually not that bad, you know, to pay up front, especially if you can have, like, that – like that combination, you know, and have it combined, because you're going to want to, like, for me, if I'm paying for a subscription, I want to make the best of it. You know, I want to make sure I kind of get my, you know, bang for the buck, right? I want to make sure I watch as much as I can. And sometimes with too many streaming subscriptions, it's like, you don't even have, because you have to pick and choose. You don't even have time to kind of, like, take in everything unless you're just a couch potato. Which this year I've been, so I've been utilizing all of my subscriptions because I've just been watching so much, you know, but this is not a normal year, right? So, that's kind of cool that they give an incentive and kind of put in the comics, you know, into the movies, I mean, into the shows. So that's cool.
Yeah. So, I guess sticking with streaming stuff, that seems to be the where all the news is being generated these days.
That's our world now, guys.
Yeah. So we did have, I guess, Let's talk about this Mandalorian thing first before we get into some of the other stuff.
Oh, because, yes, let's talk about the Mandalorian.
So Aaron has been complaining and complaining and complaining about not having a Mandalorian trailer, and he wasn't happy with the pictures that we got. And I was saying how, you know, I don't know that how much I want to see of this. Like, I'd rather not have too much before it. But Aaron finally got his trailer, and it was a hell of a trailer.
Smacked me in the face.
Yeah.
It was awesome. It was awesome. I mean, so, so much to say about this trailer. Okay. So obviously it picks right back up. Matter of fact, the voiceover in the trailer is from season one about, you know, Mando having to take the child to its rightful place with Jedi. And so the trailer is littered with Easter eggs and speculative places where Mando could potentially go. And, you know, it didn't really give us, you know, it's funny, it didn't really give us much, but it did give us a lot. So for those of us who are, like, you know, deep cut Star Wars fans, like, there's a lot to chew on. But, you know, for the average person, they're just like, oh yeah, another adventure. That seems cool. We had our first look at Sasha Banks as, I don't know who, maybe a Jedi, maybe not, maybe a bounty hunter herself, who knows, which is bananas that Sasha Banks is in Star Wars.
She's not my favorite. We all know this, but cool.
Yeah.
But she's a huge geek. Like, Sasha Banks is like a hardcore geek.
Is she?
Oh, yeah, big time. So, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Hey.
I wonder how she got involved. That would be a really interesting interview or story to find out, like, you know,
when I'm she sure
gets we'll see that afterwards. Yeah. Out.
But, you know, we get our looks at you know, Gina Carano, Carl Weathers, their characters, you know, the child, and it just looks like a crazy good time. The one thing that I will say that gets me really nervous is how, like, yes, it's Star Wars and everything is connected, right? It's in a universe that we're all familiar with. What I enjoyed most about the first season is it nodded at those connections but maintained its own course. And one of the things that I started to think about is, are we going to see the Mandalorian, like, and the series really start to connect to the movies that we've seen before? So, and this goes to some of the Easter eggs that I was talking about before. So a couple of shots, and I'll just kind of rattle them off here. So obviously we see Tatooine, right? Because we see sand people and a Bantha. And that puts us right in the territory of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Right, and that we know that a Jedi lives on Tatooine.
Yes.
So there's that. There's a shot of him, of the Mando, and the child, and this is where Sasha Banks' character comes up, you know, on a planet with a lot of water. Is that Kamino from Attack of the Clones? And there was already some hints dropped in the first season that kind of ties to Kamino, but, like, it feels like we're going to go in that direction again, because, again, there, you know, there was a quote unquote Jedi that commissioned the army of the Republic, and Jango Fett comes from there, or was there. So there's connective tissue there. Then we see an ice planet. Some people are like, oh, that's Hoth. It's not, I don't think it's Hoth at all. I think it's Elum or Elum, which is the planet where Jedi younglings and Padawans would go to get their kyber crystals and essentially make their lightsabers. That planet has popped up in the Clone Wars. That planet has popped up in the recent Star Wars video game. And the funny thing is that planet becomes the Starkiller base that we see in the sequel trilogy. So I'm seeing, like, lots of breadcrumbs, and I'm like, oh, we're going to just – are we really tying it all into the movies? Like, is that what's going to happen in this season? Again, totally speculating, and I really do hope that they're not going to do that, but
is that really what they're doing though, or is it just that this is the universe and these are places and, you know, that exist in this universe, right? So it would be like making a movie set, like, you know, in modern day, let's say like the modern day United States, and trying to pretend that like New York City doesn't exist or Los Angeles doesn't exist. Like, chances are you're going to run into some of these places, right? Because it is part of the universe. It is part of the lore. There are connections there. So, I mean, I think you can visit those places.
This is
though.
A universe.
Yeah, but you can visit those places, though, without necessarily directly connecting. Like, you could be on Tatooine, and unless, like, you walk into the events that happen in the movies on Tatooine, like, you're not necessarily connecting it directly. Mm. So I don't know that they're, I hope anyway, I think they're probably too smart for that. Yeah. I don't think that's the direction that they're going with this. I do think that they want to, you know, revisit some familiar places only because I think it does connect to the story. I mean, you know, it is the child clearly has a meaning, right? Which we're going to figure out what that is. And that, you would think, has to tie somehow directly, right, into the bigger story. Right. But, you know, yeah, I think that, I mean, I know your concern, but I don't think, because I think there's only so much you could do on this show as far as connecting it to the movies, right? Like, it's, you can't do too much of that because, we didn't see this character, you know, in the movies, right?
So, and I think that's part of the point too, is that they've used the character to explore new things that kind of enrich the universe, like bring new things. And so, like, visiting Kamino is like not a new thing. Visiting Tatooine is not a new thing. It may be in the context of the story,
sure,
right? Which is fine, but I want to see more new stuff. Like, I love that. Where they're breaking the guy out of jail, out of the prison, the galactic prison. I thought that was awesome because we've never seen anything like that before.
Sure.
But so you know, I'm just a little suspect. And we know Ahsoka Tano is going to pop up in this.
Yeah. But the thing with,
Tamora Morrison is supposed to reprise his role as either Captain Rex and or a older, Boba Fett.
Yeah.
So
the thing with that is always, we're talking about it though, right? So if you're going to have a trailer like that, a quick hitter, right? Where you're just going to, you don't have a lot of time to show things and develop things. Like, if it was something completely new and unusual, you probably would have taken it in, but like, we certainly wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. Whereas if you show like Tatooine or you show Kamino or things like that, or what you think might be Tatooine and what you think might be Kamino, that's where you're going to get a conversation going, because this is a show that, while it has broad appeal, really is, I mean, it's for the hardcore fans, right?
Yeah.
So, like, we can have this conversation. Most people aren't going to have that conversation that see that trailer.
Right.
But we're going to have this conversation and have fun with it, whereas that wouldn't have happened, you know, if they just showed some random new places. Because then you'd be like, well, what's that? Where's that? And what does that mean? And do I care about that? And it doesn't mean that these may not even be big parts of the story.
Totally. Yeah. They could be totally off. I mean, we've seen multiple snow planets. We've seen multiple desert planets. So, and the one thing that was super new, which I loved, was like the Gamorrean fighters, like the fighting kit.
Yeah.
With, you know, with those guys
that
going at it.
That looked very cool.
That scene where they're like, oh yeah, he goes wherever I go, he goes, and it's like, yeah, we know. And then they come in and you see the baby close his pod.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yes.
That's just awesome.
Yeah. Is this the best?
That was cute.
Is this the best live action Star Wars thing that has happened under the Disney umbrella?
Yes.
Yes, right? Because I was thinking that the whole time I'm watching that trailer. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, the trailers for the, and you know, the sequel trilogy are great. And, you know, nothing's, and I see this, but like, nothing's going to hit like that first Force Awakens trailer where you see...
Sure.
You know, Han Solo and Chewbacca walk back into the Falcon and he says, Chewie, we're home. Like, nothing's going to hit like that.
Right.
And nothing's going to create that feeling, but the excitement, the newness of what I would have imagined people feeling and seeing when they first saw Star Wars for the very, very first time, I feel like is represented in The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
And it's because they have pushed this universe into new territory.
Yeah.
With characters you're unfamiliar with. And look, granted, Ahsoka Tano and some of these other, like the clone troopers and some, you know, Rey, these are all new people, right? Absolutely. But those were like people we don't really understand. You know, I mean, these are like wizards, like to what he says, like, yo, you want me to drop off this baby with like a bunch of wizards and witches? Like, and it's like there is that hard, you know, that sort of raw human, like I'm just a guy thrown in this crazy world feeling, which represents the Mandalorian. And I love that. I think that's what makes Han Solo such a lovable character, is that he is sort of us thrown into the mix of all this. And he's like,
right.
You know, just,
he almost,
just a guy.
Yeah. He almost winds up being like a surrogate for the audience.
Right.
You know, like, yeah. Where it's like, okay, that's
that too.
Yeah. That's me. That would be me if I was thrown into that world. Like, I'd be that guy who'd be like questioning the realistic natures of the Force, you know, and kind of writing it off as just a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And, you know, like I would be that guy at Mos Eisley. Absolutely. Would definitely be at that place. No doubt.
And then there's like the hidden subtleties and nuances that are like kind of woven into, if we really start to think about this character and what we know about Jedi, right? Like, at this point, Luke Skywalker's a thing. Luke Skywalker already saved the galaxy, right? But, and I think we had talked about this, you know, in a couple of episodes, like previous, way, way, way back. But it's interesting because none of that stuff is real in the mind, in the hearts and minds of these characters. Like, they don't know that this stuff has actually happened, that there are those heroes out there. You know, there's still this skepticism. There's this apprehension about, like, are Jedi good? Do they actually still exist? You know what I mean? And so that's a really exciting thing for me, because while we assume that the heroes, you know, come in and save the day and that everybody knows who they are and everybody knows, you know, how great they are, that's not a real thing. It actually kind of adds a little bit of weight to this universe. It's a universe, you know, it's big. There's multiple planets. So, like, a story that may have happened on one planet has not made its way over to this other part of the galaxy. And that's dope. I love it.
I just think it would be, it is, and we've mentioned this before, but I do think it's going to be ironic that the way I see myself kind of going with this, with Disney Star Wars, is that I feel like my favorite things that they've created so far are going to wind up, or I shouldn't say that, the things that will be most endearing to me, that I will find myself watching more often, will be The Mandalorian and Rogue One.
Right.
Which are the two things that were more original and not as steeped in, like, the mythology. And, I mean, as much as I love the fun of The Force Awakens and what it meant, you know, and what the fan service and all of that. And obviously, I love The Last Jedi. But I think part of it, because of Rise of Skywalker, which I have yet to rewatch, which is amazing. Through all of this, and I probably will at some point, but I just feel like I feel myself more disconnected from that trilogy now than at any point. And I just feel like the Mandalorian is just everything I want from Star Wars right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I mean, and you know, I think to me, the thing that I actually really appreciate with even the way that they've written the character of Din Djarin and as the Mandalorian is, there's a duality in him, because he's a person of honor and a person of code, right? To a degree. Like, his whole thing about droids, like, obviously he's carrying a lot of baggage because droids killed his family, right? And so the trust of that and his relationship with IG-11, as we get to the end of the season, like, that's really, really cool stuff, right? You get to see him evolve. And to me, that is the thing that, you know, and of course, we've definitely spent more than one episode talking about The Last Jedi. I mean, that is the thing that stands out the most about, like, we've added a little bit of nuance to these characters. Like, they're not just heroes, right? These are flawed people that have been thrusted into the spotlight. And that to me, as time goes on, is why that middle piece of the sequel trilogy stands out, continues to shine in my mind, because I'm like, you had a director who was bold enough to kind of push these characters and the story and the universe in a new direction. And while he may not ever get his shot again to do more Star Wars, I think Jon Favreau and oh my God, his name.
Dave Filoni.
Yeah, Dave Filoni are, in a way, doing the same thing, but they have a little bit more street cred, right? These guys are Star Wars guys. Yeah. So, not saying that Rian Johnson was not. I'm just saying Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni have some legit street cred.
Yeah. Exactly. And Dave Filoni has told some great, been telling great Star Wars stories for a while, just really mainly for the hardcore audience.
Yeah. And he's the heart.
Yeah.
He is the beating heart of Star Wars.
Yeah. And that's why I just feel like, and you know what, maybe just let them do their thing on Disney Plus. Maybe that's the way to go going forward. But I would love to see the entire franchise kind of turned over to them. Yeah. I think Dave Filoni, as a storyteller and as a custodian of the mythology and the franchise, is perfect. His, you know, as a director, I don't know that I'm in love with him.
Yeah, and his episode that he directed, in my opinion, was like the weakest one of the season.
That's where Favreau comes in, you know, and he let him pick and choose on that side of it. But I think that combination is dynamic and is really perfect for this whole thing. So,
and the other thing too is Favreau is very, very much like George Lucas in that.
Yeah,
he's experimental and he's brought on new technology, and that technology is, I mean, it's critically acclaimed, right? Yeah. It's gotten awards, it's won Emmys.
Sure. And he's obviously he's willing to turn things over to other directors.
Yeah.
Which is the thing that, ironically, Lucas was smart enough to do with his original trilogy and not smart enough to do with the sequel trilogy, with the prequel trilogy, rather. And it's unfortunately the thing that narratively hurt the sequel trilogy, was the fact that it didn't have that one guiding force, despite the director changes, you know, because then it just went in too many different directions. So I wouldn't mind if they became like the curators of Star Wars, Star Wars going forward. But
all interesting shit.
Sure.
That's for sure.
Yep. So a couple other things. We got some Disney Plus Marvel news, right? Yeah. So She-Hulk has been the lead, and that has been cast. It is very exciting, actually. It's Tatiana Maslany, who starred in Orphan Black, one of my favorite shows of all time.
Yes.
If you haven't watched Orphan Black and you're a sci-fi fan, you should, because it's brilliant for 5 seasons. I don't really want to get into too much about it, because the more you know about the show, the less you know about the show going in, the better the experience will be for you. And I think it's available like on Amazon, and I think it's available on a bunch of different streaming services. I know it's available on Amazon. So you should watch Orphan Black if you haven't already. But she's brilliant. She plays, like, on Orphan Black, she played, I think over the course of the 5 seasons, she played 14 different characters, but she played 5 main characters, like, at the same time.
Yeah.
And in a way where you wouldn't even know the difference. Like, you wouldn't even realize, like, you forget after a while, right, that you're watching the same actress when they're interacting with each other.
It's really incredible to watch. And for an actor, it's like watching a masterclass, you know. Every single episode, you're just enthralled by how she can differentiate all of these characters, and it's played by the same person, you know, just like what she picks and chooses and how she changes her mannerisms to fit into these characters that she's playing. It really is like truly a joy to watch. My favorite story that I read in a magazine about her was that when she was auditioning for this role in Canada, she, like, first of all, she rollerbladed to her audition, which I think was in the article, which I thought was, like, super cool that she rollerbladed there. Has nothing to do with it, but I thought that was super cool. She, like, yeah, it was just, like, so carefree of her. And they said that she spent her time in the waiting room helping other actresses, like, with their lines, that the other actresses didn't even know that, like, she was going also for the same part. She had just had it so down packed and wasn't even nervous that she was, like, helping other people in the room. Yeah. I think that says a lot about her, because it's such a competitive business, and, you know, women especially, you know, in acting are also really competitive. And the fact that she was just like, cool, I'm just gonna, like, rollerblade to the audition. Like, she didn't even think she was gonna, like, get anything. She just had zero expectation. And I think it was because of that, like, you know, in acting we say, like, if you have tension, like, you really need to relax your body so you can let out everything that you need to, right? Because your body's your instrument. And I think just the fact that she just, like, rolled on in there, helped people out, you know, helped these actresses out, whatever, probably not going to get this part anyway, let me just go in and do whatever I need to do, and then walked out with, like, the role of a lifetime.
Yeah.
That was just, like, my favorite story I read when I first got into the show. And I think she's going to be incredible in whatever she does. I know she's on Perry Mason now, which I haven't watched on HBO.
I just realized that. And I'm now going to absolutely watch that.
I'll watch anything she's in. Yeah. Now that I've heard that, I'm definitely going to watch it.
Aaron, have you seen Orphan Black?
I have not.
You should.
And I was, like, totally unfamiliar with the actress. So hearing you guys talk about her gets me really excited.
Yeah, watch Orphan Black.
So to go see Orphan Black, but also the potential for her in the role of She-Hulk.
So she'll be playing
Jennifer, the character.
The character is Jennifer Walters. She's an attorney and the cousin of Bruce Banner. You know, we'll see what happened. She gets an emergency blood transfusion from her cousin, of course, and that's how she gets her powers. But
I'm excited to see how they're going to do this.
Yeah, Jessica Gao, who was a Rick and Morty writer, she's going to be leading the writers' room, and Kat Cuero is going to be directing the pilot and apparently a few other episodes. So, pretty exciting there, and also, they released a trailer for WandaVision, which is just batshit crazy.
I got lost. I had no idea what the hell I was watching.
It's exactly what they said it was going to be, which is, but it, just because they said it was going to be that, like, I was like, is really, that's what it's going to be? And sure enough, yes.
Sure enough, it is.
It's exactly what it's going to be. It's, I don't even know what would you describe it as, like, of 50s
I Love Lucy
sitcom meets like a Marvel show.
I don't know what it is, to be honest with you. There looked like there was some crazy shit going on though towards the end of it. And then we get our first shot of I think Monica Rambeau, who wife, I think she does she become I forgot what hero she becomes. But anyways, there's, that was just a trippy ass.
It really,
So.
Trippy, that's a good word for it.
Yeah. I'm excited to see it, though. I want, you know, this is their time to stretch their wings and experiment, right? And see what works and what doesn't. And, you know, there's supposed to be some big things for the character of Scarlet Witch. We'll see how this all transpires and works out for her.
It also reminded me, like, when she's, like, in the trailer, when she's, like, sitting on, there was, like, just a quick little glimpse of her sitting on the couch and, like playing with her powers. It kind of reminded me of Bewitched.
Yeah.
I used to love Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie when I was a kid. When I was a little girl, I used to watch like Nick at Night all the time.
Sure.
And it kind of brought back those memories. And if they can implement something like that
I think that's what they're alluding to, because she's got the whole hairstyle and all that too, right? The little bob thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That looks so cool.
It looks really, really interesting. And I'm excited to check that out. And then
I just want to know if she's gonna like keep the accent or like drop the accent. I don't know if you guys have noticed this in the movies, but
drop shit.
The accent is not.
She dropped that accent in after Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm serious. Yeah, it's gone.
I know. Yeah, but I feel like I feel like it like kind of comes up sometimes in the later movies.
I don't know. I'm glad she dropped it though. And I hope
sometimes really you just bad. Have to. I don't know if you've ever seen Robin Hood Prince of Thieves. The Kevin Costner one.
Redness.
Like Kevin Costner, by the middle of that film, he's given up and he's just like, he's not even trying. He's just like, yeah, I'm Sir Robin of Locksley. What do you make of it? You know, like he doesn't even try to have an accent. He tries in the beginning and he's like, you know what? They must have been like, dude, like we got to finish this film. Forget it. Like just ditch the accent.
It's kind of funny. So, you know, I know we talked a little bit about this when we were discussing Bill and Ted, but like I watched, because I've been like all over the place watching YouTube shit, and it was acting coaches critiquing Keanu Reeves' performances.
Oh no!
Oh yeah! And they, of course, they brought up Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Ugh, my favorite.
But one of the nicest. We were talking about really bad acting. But one of the nicest things they said about him was that he progressively gets better in the film. Which, and I thought about it. And like he kind of does, because well, he's not really the focus anymore. Right. But they're saying he was learning a lot from Gary Oldman, who was just a tour de force.
Sure.
So, but the accent thing came.
It's funny, you know. I think what makes Keanu Reeves, his awfulness in that movie stand out so much is the fact that there's a lot of greatness happening around him.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're just bad in like a bad movie, it's like. Usually you just kind of write it off as like, well, this is just a bad movie, right? You don't usually single out like the acting. When you have a good movie, like a really good movie with some really great performances, especially, you know, Gary Oldman's in your movie, like, yes, a terrible performance is going to, like I always say, Keanu Reeves like brings that movie to a grinding halt every time he's on the screen. And that's what it feels like. It's because you have this terrible performance in this great movie with these great performances. So that's what makes that one stand out even more, because it's unusual. It's like Sofia Coppola in Godfather Part 3. You know, it's like, you know what I mean? Like when you have a situation like that, it's like it just stands out even more. Because
there's that and the whole like incest thing.
Well, yeah.
That's
right. But
you know.
But
hey,
I mean,
cuz, hey, what's up, cuz? Hey.
Yeah.
Ew, don't ever do that again.
Yeah.
Wow. That was graphic. Gross. Yeah.
Disgusting.
But so when you have a bad performance in an otherwise good movie with good performances, like it they're going to stand out more than just bad performances in bad movies, because bad movies are usually just everything's bad. So, anyway,
one thing before we wrap up on the Marvel TV, but Falcon and the Winter Soldier is back in production.
Yes,
nice set photos from Anthony Mackie. So that's another one I'm excited to check out. So Marvel train is rolling, but it's only on TV.
Yeah, things are picking up. Auditions are coming in. They're like doing background again in New York. I know like SVU, Law and Order SVU like just started. So New York is kind of slowly creeping back, and all of these other productions are, you know, kind of like kicking it off. So that's really comforting to see, because it's just a sign of, you know, some normalcy that we were used to 7 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So we shall see. Oh, Aaron, your show, The Watchmen, Emmys tonight, they just won.
Did they really?
Yep, they for did. What? For best limited series.
That's awesome.
Amazing
show.
I think the other actor won an Emmy as well.
Wait, what other actor? Regina.
Regina King won, and I'm gonna get his name right. Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
Yep.
Get
out of he here. Won for best supporting actor in a limited series movie. She won for lead actress in a limited series movie, and the show won for best limited series.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah, such a great show.
That show. So, and you know what? It's timely as hell.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
That's awesome. All right, cool. What else, Chris? It sounded like you were going to say something else before I catch
up. No, I think that's... Because I was actually going to say, I forgot how we even got to... How did we get to Keanu Reeves from WandaVision?
Accents.
Oh, accents, right. There we go. That's interesting.
Yeah.
We should put this out there for those of you, for you listeners who like to interact with us. What are some of your, like, what are some movies where you actually think there were terrible acting performances by actors in an otherwise good movie with good acting? You know, so like your Keanu Reeves is in Dracula and things like that. Like, what are some of your worst acting performances in a good movie with good acting? I'd be curious to see if anybody else has some other ideas. Hmm. While we're thinking about that, I guess the other thing I had for this week was the fact that, and I know you had mentioned that this wasn't really news, but I saw it pop up on Twitter last week, a couple days ago, that Cobra Kai apparently will be heading to Japan for season 3. Ralph Macchio talked about that. That's exciting. I don't know if people have finally had a chance to check out Cobra Kai now that it's on Netflix. Hopefully the whole world has, because it's great. But I can't wait for season 3. I mean, they still don't know when that's happening yet, but...
I'm sure sometime soon. It's kind of funny because there have been like memes all over the place about how, like, you know, people are going nuts about Cobra Kai, and like, you know, we've seen it like 2 years ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, like, people are sharing their excitement again. I think that's what Netflix was doing. They wanted to see if there was still an appetite for this and. Get people talking about it again, and then they just smash them in the face with, "Hey, guess what? Season 3 is coming." Season 3 is coming.
Sorry, that
in
was
the near
my
term.
Dog.
It's like, did you step on your dog? Is your dog
no,
okay?
I'm sorry, guys. He's just a Pomeranian, and they're called Yaparanians. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry.
You know, and we actually forgot a big piece of news that the Marvel Cinematic Universe cast a major villain. Right, or what we think might be a major villain this week. Jonathan Majors, who is the star of HBO's Lovecraft Country and Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, he's joining Ant-Man 3. Now, they haven't announced the role yet, but Deadline reported that he's going to be playing Kang the Conqueror. So unless you believe that, because it's an Ant-Man movie, right, and it is Ant-Man 3. Unless you believe they're going to go like with a Mandarin route, right. You know, it's very possible that Kang the Conqueror could be one of the big bads in this new phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Or he should be anyway, right? If they do the character right, so
right.
It's just interesting that
that's exciting news. That is exciting news.
Yeah,
that's a weird ass character, first of all. But again, it pushes more into the sort of the galactic
cosmic
territory that we've been cosmic. That's what I'm sorry. That was the word I was trying to say. Cosmic territories that we you know, we've been sort of dabbling in a little bit in the MCU. So, and we always knew that this was going to be a thing for these next phases. So I'm excited to see where this goes. But that's a crazy, crazy villain to explore.
Yeah, it's funny. So it's almost like you forget about Marvel sometimes, and and then it's like, oh right, they have a whole new phase and, you know, new thing that they're about to do, and you know, let's see. It's almost like they're starting from scratch, kind of, you know, a little bit. Anyway,
yeah.
Which is exciting in a way, because it gives you a chance to become familiar with some new characters. Yeah, I mean, there's still some old standbys still left, right? I mean, you still have Thor, and you still have Ant-Man, obviously, and the Guardians of the Galaxy, and Spider-Man, you know. Yeah, so we'll have to see.
And I mean, and then there's rumors that Olivia Wilde's Spider-Woman is in some way attached to the MCU.
Is that official, too?
Oh, interesting.
It's not official. It's a rumors.
No, I mean official rumors as far as that she's playing Spider-Woman.
Rumors. Like, even with all of that, like, she was hinting at some of this stuff. And, you know, I read an article or something that she talked with Feige. So, I don't know what any of this means. I don't believe shit until I see, an announcement. Like, a legit announcement.
Right.
Like, F what you do on your social media feeds.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you what, though. Quick shout out. Not to do, but quick shout out to Special Effects, our boy Phil's comic auction site. But he had the first Spider-Woman comic book up for grabs, and I bagged it.
Oh, that's cool.
Right. Yeah. So I got that joint.
Nice.
Yeah.
And
I also got the first appearance of Spider-Man 2099, because I have a feeling that bomb is going to pop up in the next Into the Spider-Verse. So I am cashing in on all Spider-Man things.
Have you watched the Spider-Woman cartoons on Disney Plus? The old one.
I've never seen those like a while ago. It's been a while.
Yeah, I tried to watch them a couple months ago because I don't remember watching Spider-Woman much like as a kid. It wasn't great. But so I think part of it is because, like, you know, so much of that is about nostalgia, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't have the nostalgia for that show that I have for like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends or really any of those. I just thought it's funny that it's there. I guess it's ironic or not ironic that it's up there on Disney Plus, since they are going to maybe be revisiting that character in some way, shape, or form. So,
mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. So, I don't know if we have anything else. If not, I guess we could get out of here.
I think we're good.
Yep. All right. So, of course, you can go to thefanboygarage.com, check out our episodes, check out our merch store, and you can join the conversation on the social medias, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, at the Fanboy Garage. I'm on Twitter at RealCLMighty.
I'm at @banana_TFG.
And you can find me on Twitter at @AAronSpeaks. That is @A_A_RonSpeaks. One last shout out. Just want to give a shout out to our boy Ashri, and his mod shop Modified.
Yeah.
Out in Brooklyn. It's a garage. He's been showing us some crazy love. Bought a mask, got a picture of him with a Knight Rider.
Let's talk about that for a second. He forget the mask, which is cool, and thanks. He built a Knight Rider car.
I know.
Like, uh-huh. Can we, like, that is, like, the coolest thing ever.
Yes.
Knight Rider was one of my obsessions as a kid. My parents, who I think are listening to this, they know the frustration that my father had to go to get me that kit car when it first came out that you couldn't find anywhere that had the Michael Knight figure. I mean, I loved Knight Rider. And when I saw that car, you posted that picture of him with the mask, and I'm like, oh, that's cool, but that car, like, that's what we should be talking about.
Pretty dope. So
he's a cool cat.
Yeah. So Ashrio, thank you so much again for the support. And if you guys are interested in cars and the stuff he's got going on, definitely check him out on Instagram, modify.d. Yeah. And that's it. That's all I got. So thanks again so much for listening to episode 113 of the Fanboy Garage. Always a pleasure to have you guys with us, and we hope to see you guys next week. Thanks.
You're listening to the Fanboy Garage Podcast.